So it didn't have an audio recording.
Okay. So the primary document for the course is the syllabus, which is handed out. Everybody get one?
Okay.
And this is all reproduced on the course website. It's basically just, the syllabus is just these links concatenated together and turned into a PDF file. So this is the website, and that is my primary means for communicating to you. That is where I host the homeworks and other news as events warrant. The Canvas site will mostly just direct you to this. Like, I won't use Canvas a whole lot. I might post things there, but if so, I'll let you know here to go there. And otherwise, just go here. I've posted dates and things. The midterm is at an obvious time before fall break, and the final is towards the end of the final period. By policy, we're supposed to have finals in. So if that date is a problem for you, let me know sooner rather than later. Hopefully you show up for the exams. That is critical. If for some reason you get hit by a bus or whatever, please try to contact me before exam time, so I know. Right. I mean, it's all pretty straightforward. Nice to be back in person.
Have you set a date for the midterm or just the week?
Yes, I'm trying to remember what it is offhand. It is on the website link.
Okay.
And it is like the Thursday before break, something like that. I know everybody does it then, and I'm sorry, but I've tried in the past to try to dodge other people doing that. It never works out, so that's just what it is. Other questions? Right. Okay. This is a interesting time in cosmology. I will sometimes write on that board, but for the moment I will turn off that light. Yeah, that's pretty good. This is an image from the recently launched JWST. This is not an unrealistic image. I think it's Photoshop fake, but the heat shielding is kind of pinkish when you unroll it. It's got a stack of them, because basically you got to keep this between the sun and the telescope, because the telescope operates in the infrared part of the spectrum, and you have to keep it cold. And so there's a huge temperature gradient between each of these successive layers, which are about the size of a tennis court. It's a big object in space. And the unfurling of those things was a nerve-wracking experience. There were over 300 events that had to happen to unpack this thing in space, and any one of those could have screwed the whole mission. You know, $10 billion, what are we, the military or something? So it worked. It was an amazing piece of technology. It's now returning data, which are fabulous. This is just one of the early images, not even a particularly deep image. And pretty much everything in this frame is a galaxy way out there in the universe. Very small batch of sky, imaged very deeply. And in the infrared parts of the spectrum, and the advantage of that, reason this was conceived this way back in the 90s was because we learn, like, it's redshifted as you look further out, the rust frame gets shifted to other bands. So if you want to see what our eyes are seeing, you need to see where that light has been shifted to, right? So really high redshift galaxies, we're looking at the ultraviolet part of the spectrum when it was emitted with our eyes now. We'd like to see it as it would appear to us in its rest frame, right? And so that was the large motivation for JWST, was basically to look so that both redshifted galaxies would look normal to us. And that's one of the amazing things to me right away. If you look at the really deep Hubble Space Telescope images, there are lots and lots of galaxies there, and lots of them look like little stringy things and blue lumps and whatnot. And many of us said, I remember a long time ago, Hubble first did its deep images, discussing with Professor Mihos, there were things like this and things like this, except only that part. And like, geez, that sort of looks like, people were calling them chain galaxies. It also looks like that's what a galaxy would look like if you could only see the ultraviolet part of the really hot stars. And sure enough, that's immediately what we see in here. You see the entire galaxy now because you're seeing the optical light as it was emitted in by the galaxy originally. And so the big galaxies are, the relatively bright galaxies are relatively nearby to us, still a long dang ways away by human scale. And as you go to these fainter dots, those are all still galaxies, they're just so dang far away, they're that much fainter. And so we'll talk about how you can learn about the universe simply by counting galaxies and doing other things, but some of those faintest little dots are remarkably far away, high redshift, redshifts of 6, 5, some 10 have been claimed already. Redshift is just the shift in the spectrum, fundamental quantity in cosmology. Well, easiest way to define it is just where lambda is the wavelength. You observe it at some wavelength, it was emitted at some other wavelength. So if it was emitted in the optical part of the spectrum, it gets redshifted by the expansion in the universe to some redder wavelength. And so if you say that's 10, that means something that started out in the UV of 1,000 angstroms is now out at 1 micron. All the way from the hard ultraviolet to into the infrared, right past our optical spectrum. So that's what JWST was built to implicitly correct for. These infrared detectors that, like I say, have to be kept super cold on the and shaded from the sun. A lot of that cooling is just passive. The shading is really, really effective because space is cold. Sun is hot, so if you can make a good shade, that cools it. Some of them have to be actively cooled, so you have some cryogenic material, I forget, probably liquid helium for what this is doing. Eventually that runs out, and that end dates the mission lifetime for those particular instruments. And passive ones can operate until some piece of space junk smashes it. Which, this is out at an orbit of L2, so it's not too crowded out there, unlike low Earth orbit, like where Hubble is, it gets dinged up all the time. Nothing catastrophic so far, but dinged up. Right, so this is cool. This is brand new, right? JWST launched at the beginning of the year. It started doing science data last month. Like, there are already debates going on in the preprints about what's going on. Oh yeah, there's a link for the working grades, gives you the proportion. It's mostly a little bit of homework exams. And for those of you at the 400 level, there will be a project at the end. I will ask you to investigate the value of some cosmological parameter and come back and report on that to the class. So we'll slide the class. You'll want to consult with me about that project. But that's way off for now. Okay, now cosmology is a subject that is very close to both religion and philosophy. And we have always asked the big questions, and we have always made stuff up. And we should not ever forget that we are still humans. We may know more than the ancients did, but we're still making a lot of stuff up. So now remember this, if you go back and look at the creation myths of ancient peoples, they always are some variation of the gods messing with each other In the Egyptian case, Shu didn't like that a couple of other gods were snuggling, and so he physically separated them, froze them into place, became the land and the sky. And implicit in that, and in many human cosmologies, is the notion of up and down. Right? If you are living on Earth and all you have are your senses, that is a pretty fundamental distinction that you just take for granted. Right? So all these creation myths always have, you know, there's the ground, there's the sky, there's the separation between them, and there's almost no effort to explain why there's up and down. It just is. Okay. This brings me to a pet peeve of science fiction tropes. So if you look at a lot of science fiction stories like Star Trek or anything that involves space travel, it is very common to depict spaceships with people sort of like sailing ships. They stand up this way with the direction of motion going that way. That is stupid. Okay? If you are in some kind of spaceship, then up is defined for you by the thrust of whatever magical device you're using to fling yourself through space. So never mind that this is physically impossible, it's just you would not go this way. There is no such thing as gravity plating decks, and this, you know. There are different levels of the suspension of disbelief, and as much as one might like these stories, it's just like, oh, come on, this is cool enough, right? Just remember, up is defined by this. And so this is the a picture of the Artemis spacecraft that was supposed to launch yesterday. Sort of a redo of the Apollo missions to the moon. This is a big wonking rocket. As I understand it, launched with scrub because it uses basically the same hydrogen engines that the shuttle did. Really efficient, burning hydrogen and oxygen straight to water vapor. It's a really good chemical reaction. But you're feeding a whole lot of liquid hydrogen, which is super cold, through these nozzles. And so you have to pre-cool the nozzles before you start blasting tons of material through them and lighting them on fire. And one of the, so the way to do that is just drizzle a little liquid hydrogen. Sounds easy, right? the cryogenics to do that is not trivial. But anyway, you pre-cool, and one of the three main engines did not reach the required temperature to launch, so they scrub. Hopefully that'll work out. Solid rocket boosters, basically again the same technology as the shuttle, just bigger. And I mention all this not just to rag on Star Trek, which I otherwise like, but because there is an important physical principle here. It's the equivalence principle. Free fall is universal. Right, so you take an object and you drop it on the surface of the Earth, it accelerates at 1g, 9.8 meters per second per second. Doesn't matter if it's lead or feathers or whatever, right? It's the same thing for everything. And the reason for that is that inertial mass is apparently the same as gravitational charge, which we all learn from our youth, except it's obvious. Doesn't make a whole lot of sense, though. Think about it. Or at least the structure of Newton's law of gravity is exactly the same as electrostatic charges. Right? There's a strength constant for how strong the force is. There are two charges. You multiply together, and that over the inverse distance gives you the force. Exactly the same formulas for electrostatics. But with mass playing the role of gravitational charge. And so in principle, that gravitational charge could be different from the inertial mass, which is what appears in the second law. Right? How hard do you have to push a mass to get it to accelerate? For gravity, gravity is special, and those things are the same. So sometimes you'll hear that stated as the equivalence principle. It's actually a much stronger version of the equivalence principle than just saying free fall is universal. Because you can't imagine violating this and still having lead and feathers fall the same way. But this is all very fundamental to what we have, and as a practical matter, this is the version of the Einstein elevator experiment. If you're in a closed box,
here on the earth, well, you still feel 1G, right? You can't see outside, you don't know what's going on, but you can feel that 1G, and if you drop something, it accelerates the way you expect. If you magically translate that box to a rocket in the middle of space, and that rocket is accelerating at exactly 1G, you can't tell the difference. Right? So that's the equivalence. Gravity isn't a force in the sense of the other forces. You cannot tell the difference between being accelerated by the rocket or feeling the force of gravity here on the surface of the Earth. And that's part of the reason why it's been so hard to combine gravity with the other forces into some grander theory. Now, since Artemis was about to launch, I was reminded about this amusing way of illustrating the Saturn rocket, which is the same scale. You need something that big to get to the moon. And let's see if it works. Yep, there we go. Those are elephants being flung out the back. The mass flow rate of the rocket like this is about one elephant per second. So that's a lot of mass to throw out the back. So if you want to build a rocket that'll get substantial payloads to the moon, that's pretty much what you want to do. And you don't want to be anywhere close to it when it launches, right? So that's another science fiction trope. Oh, goodbye, alien spaceship. You do not want to be close to a launch of something that can move a lot of mass into orbit, because Earth is a big gravity well and it's hard to dig out. Okay, so we'll spend a lot of this talk, of course, talking about how one observationally maps the universe, because that's a fundamental cartographic exercise, just what does the universe look like. You go out in a dark place and look at the sky when it's clear, and you see stars, right? Milky Way galaxy is made of stars. You look outside of that, well, you saw the JWST picture, the universe is made of galaxies. There's a lot of empty space with galaxies here and there, just like the Milky Way, there's a lot of empty space with stars here and there. So, you know, right away that is a fundamental observation about the nature of the universe that didn't have to be that way. So just mapping things is an observational challenge. And again, people have been doing this for a long time. So this is the map of Hesiodus, of Miletus. Miletus was a Greek city-state on the Ionian coast, Asia Minor, what is modern-day Turkey, about there. This is about 500 BC. And the Greeks were sailors, and you see there's a lot of detail about the Ionian coast and the Greek coast where the population was concentrated. They knew about all the little islands, they knew about Sicily, they knew about the Adriatic coast and the general shape of the boot of Italy. You get beyond that and it's a little more, oh yeah, there's a coastline there, oh yeah, Iberia is over there, Africa's down here. And so basically the detail of the map is in direct proportion to the distance, right? The things nearby they knew really well. And as you get further away, it becomes more and more speculative until you get out near the edge of these things and it's like, eh, you know. People were not dumb. I've not been to Hesiodus, to Miletus, I don't know if there are any ruins there, but not too far away is Ephesus. This was a major Roman city about 500 years after that, so long time, you and me. This is really a thriving metropolis in Roman times, right down to, you know, the rich people had their homes up in the hills and everything we recognize about inequality today. It was a coastal city. It's now been silted in. A couple thousand years later, it's 10 kilometers away from the sea, mostly buried. So this is just a little bit that's excavated. But the point is that people back then were plenty sophisticated. The ones that bothered to think about this were not dumb. And they had a pretty good detailed knowledge of what was within their reach. when you get outside of the reach of your knowledge, that's when you start making stuff up.
Right. You know, Earth is flat, you sail too far, and you fall off the edge, you're monsters, all that kind of thing. Right? It's an example of making stuff up. We're always, always filling that stuff in with examples, and we're not done doing that. Major elements of the modern cosmology, which we basically just made up. This basic picture is very common to all early civilizations. The Incans had a similar picture. There's a flat earth that's within a sphere that represents the sky. That sphere turns around, so the stars rise and set. Right? And you can, there's the constellations of the Milky Way, the sun, the moon, all the usual things, the cardinal points. Interesting, the Mesoamerican peoples didn't use orthogonal north, south, east, west. The way Western cultures do, the cardinal points they had were summer solstice, sunrise, sunset, and winter solstice, sunrise and sunset. Just a different choice of directions, but things pegged to the appearance on the sky from where we observe it. Perfectly sensible cosmology based on what your eyes can tell. And so if you go and read Harrison's Cosmology, I should have mentioned this is the book, not Harrison's Cosmology, but Barbara Ryden, second edition of her book. Whenever I refer to specific things in this textbook, it'll be to the second edition. You can use the first edition just fine, but there's a change in the pagination and the chapter number, so you have to be careful to get the numbers right. It shouldn't be too important for you, but just so you say, when I refer to readings on the lecture page, so on the home page there's a link to the lectures. That's where I will post the slides and the audio, and I'll also give links to or directions to the corresponding readings in this book. So I'm referring to the chapter numbers in the second edition. And I'll also give other things. Harrison has a great outdated, but great book that goes through all this sort of philosophical stuff. And so I've adopted his scheme here to classify cosmologies by the sort of corresponding ancient philosophers that advocated that basic kind of worldview. So the Aristotelian universe is basically your standard issue human cosmology, if all you know is what you can see. Earth is fixed and in the center. The sky is a rigid sphere that circles around us. It's the rising and setting motion of the stars. And that immediately means that such a universe is finite. Right? Aristotle thought about this, the whole Platonic school thought about this. And he's like, well, you know, it goes around once a day, so it can't be moving infinitely fast. Right, so that shell, they really envisioned there was an outer shell to which the stars were attached. So that had to be some finite distance away just so it could make it around in a finite amount of time. Very sensible thing. You could generalize that, right? Nowadays we know the speed of light is the fastest you could go. So that sets an upper limit on how big such a universe could be. Can't be spinning faster than the speed of light. So in that picture, the universe is finite. We are in the center of it, geocentric, and it has a hard edge. People always want to ask what's beyond the edge of the universe. Well, in this, there was a hard edge, but it's not answered what's beyond that. That is, of course, one of these questions you can't really answer, and so you're always making stuff up. The Stoic school took a more Stoic picture. I mean, it basically said, well, we don't know how far the universe goes, but we're not comfortable saying it has a hard edge. So let's just say it extends indefinitely. I mean, that's really a very mature way of looking at it. We don't know. It seems to go out a long way. Maybe it's infinite even, but we don't know that. It's just sort of indefinite.
And so the edge of that thing is kind of mushy. It's not a hard edge. Maybe there is an edge. Yeah. That picture in the ancient times was still geocentric. The Earth was still at the middle. But this motivated the Victorian era cosmology, in which not the Earth was at the center, but the Milky Way was pretty much everything, and we happened to be near the center of it. So these ideas come up over and over again. And this was successful for many decades. And then it's sort of what Harrison calls the Epicurean version. We usually associate the Epicurean school of thought with pleasure, where the Stoics are very enduring. The Epicureans are, let's party! I mean, basically, they literally take it as a principle that the best thing you can do is enjoy life. And they do mean the pleasures of the flesh. But they thought about these things too and had some pretty clever things, and they just said that the only thing that made sense is if the universe was truly infinite. And they inferred from that there should be many worlds with many peoples living on them. They really had very much in mind that we were not the only planet, they wouldn't have used quite those terms, but that there would be other life forms elsewhere, and it didn't really make sense to them otherwise in the vast universe that it could be any other way. So there's no specific center to that, which is good, right? Finally get to a cosmology that does not violate the Copernican principle by putting us in a special place. And there's no edge because it goes on forever. And this is essentially the qualitatively what we have in our modern worldview. Now, again, people were not dumb. They thought about this very carefully. And so if you look at the Aristotelian style universes with the Earth at the center, they knew the order of events here. They could figure out that the planets were moving around relative to the stars. They had to be closer. So the stars are all affixed to the most distant shell. But you had these different layers of celestial spheres. To which the various bright lights of the sky were attached. The moon, closest to us, Mercury, Venus, the sun. That ordering is important. There are observational reasons for that. And then beyond the sun, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn. And then there's this other allowance for, there's the firmament with the stars, but you might have some comets and other periodic things out there, and it was a big perturbation on this picture when Tycho's comet came around. Tycho Brahe figured out, well, that thing is out there. I can do parallax and figure out its distance, and it's somewhere in between here, which implied it was cutting across the celestial spheres, which until that time a lot of people imagined were real physical things, which the planets were attention. You couldn't see them; they were invisible. But they were, you know, literally crystalline spheres to which these lights were attached, and they spun around in some kind of mechanical way. And until you had observations like that, that was not unreasonable. The Stoic universe is like, okay, this is sort of like the map of Thucydides. It's like, yeah, we see there's stuff here, and then you go farther out, you know, it's basically this entire solar system is inside here now, but then there are stars, but they're not saying the stars are affixed to a solid shell. They're just out there, they diffuse invisible indefinitely, and even though the Earth is at the center, now it's the Earth that has to spin around to give you the rising and setting motions. Right? So those are symmetric things, you can't really tell the difference. It doesn't feel right to imagine that we're on a spinning body, because of course if you get on a merry-go-round, you can feel the spinning. Understand now the Earth is really big, so we don't notice that, but they understood that you should. And so the Stoics were also responsible for atoms imagining that there was a finite quantum below which you could not subdivide. And so it just goes off to this indefinite chaos of atoms. This is a lot like what you will see for the Victorian picture of the universe, just with the Milky Way replacing the solar system at the center. And then we have our modern Epicurean universe. Again, here's a JWST image with all these galaxies out there going off to infinity as far as we can tell. We don't know that because you can't see the infinity. And a curious addition to our modern worldview is that the age of this universe is finite. The spatial extent may go on forever and ever, but the age is finite, and so light has only had that finite amount of time to get to us, 13 or 14 billion years. And that sets our horizon. Just like you can look out from a tall building and you can see a long ways out, but you don't see all the way around the Earth, right? You see off to some horizon where the Earth curves away from you. For the universe, that horizon is imposed by the light travel time, and so the space may be infinite, but we see a finite portion of that. That's just an artificial horizon, just like it is here on Earth, imposed by the light travel time. So spatially infinite, but finite in age. So there's this sort of picture. Now, I bother to say this because we now laugh at this, right? This was the most successful cosmology in history. Platonic school sort of jotted it down a few hundred BC. It wasn't until a few hundred AD that Ptolemy actually worked out a model that worked. So they had the idea of epicycles, but the Platonic school couldn't actually make a model that fit the data. This is one of the origins, if you ever hear philosophers talk about saving the phenomenology. Saving the phenomena is not really very satisfactory. Well, we think it works like this. Can't actually make it work, but it works like this. Ptolemy actually made it work, but he had a really complicated system for doing that. It wasn't just that he had epicycles, but there were big orbits with the planets moving on small orbits as well as the big orbits. But there were also deferents where the main circle was offset from this from each other in all these different places. And an offset circle is a decent approximation to an ellipse, right? So what he had found was a clever way of doing what Kepler later figured out, is that really the orbits are elliptical. But people were really obsessed with the heavens being perfect and circles being a perfect shape. And so that really, one of the most hard things, I think, for Kepler to wrap his head around was that ellipses could be possible. Up until then, it had to be a circle for philosophical reasons. And once he realized that, it's like, oh, that explains everything. That was really a critical event in the history of science. Now we look at it and we recognize that a circle is just a special case of an ellipse, right? So in some sense, the ellipse is the nice generalization that makes, you know, beautiful sense. They had exactly the opposite attitude back then, that the circle was a perfect shape. Heaven shouldn't do anything dirty like moving ellipses. So this was basically what everybody believed for a couple thousand years. And it's basically imprinted on every early culture, because this is the most sensible thing you can come up with based on what you can see. The Stoic cosmology came up again in Victorian times, 1785. I'll give you the reason for that date. And that lasted until the end of the 1920s. And our modern cosmology has only been around for 90 years. Okay. So these things change, and they can change again. I'm going to teach you why we think we believe these things, but I won't promise it won't change again. Yeah.
If the Epicurean cosmology was kind of started in the 20th century, what was the reason for having that name?
So the Epicureans did talk about an infinite universe. So it was revived at this time, just as, you know, it's very hard to have an original thought, right? So the same thing for heliocentric cosmology. We attribute that to Copernicus.
And he basically repopularized that. There was one of the ancient philosophers, Aristarchus, who advocated for exactly that case, that no, the Earth's not in the middle, the Sun's in the middle, we go around that. And everybody said he was stupid. The only reason that we even know he existed was because everybody else loved to criticize him. And it's only the criticisms that have survived. Right. So, he could be right, but that doesn't mean people will believe you. I explicitly use these names to point out that these ideas have been had before. This has come up again. And really, the modern version started with Hubble's discovery of the distance to Andromeda. So I'm telling you all this because you got to know where we're coming from. I could just start teaching you the details of Lambda CDM. Lambda CDM is what we will spend most of the semester talking about. It's also kind of crazy if you stop and think about it. So there are really good reasons why we have arrived at that as an answer. But it's important to appreciate where we're coming from. And these things, no matter how well established, can change. Oh, the Earth's at the center and the Sun's at the center. Oh, no big. This happens all the time. Not like that. But big changes do happen. All right, so I had picked 1785 as the modern version of the Stoic picture of cosmology, because the work of the Herschels, William Herschel, published this map in 1785 in the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society. This is still a journal that exists. And what he did was very clever. He went out and counted stars. So imagine being at some location, and you go out and just look all around the sky and count how many stars you can see. Well, there are some directions that have more stars and other directions that have fewer stars. You can see this with your eye. And what he did was quantify this into a map by making some simplifying assumptions that we do all the time. And he basically assumed that all the stars were as bright as the Sun. Sun is a star, it's a typical star. On average, that's what we're looking at. That's not right, but it's not unreasonable to do, and it's close enough to build this kind of a map. And so in the directions where you can see lots and lots of stars, you infer, because you're seeing lots of faint stars over here, that they're farther away, and therefore this thing is bigger. And so this is literally the layout of the Milky Way that Herschel envisioned. And we're looking down on it like a map of the Earth, because it's very thin, right? So in this direction, it's not very big, and this direction is big. And you can tell that it's not very thick, because you can see that with your eye is the band of the Milky Way stretching across the sky. So this is in the plane of the Milky Way. And so this is an artist's depiction of that edge on view. There is some finite thickness, but there is a primary ridge along which the star counts are highest. And as you go away from that, in modern parlance, we'd say to increasing galactic latitude, you go away from the plane of the Milky Way, then the star counts get less, and then there's nothing out there. So this is, of course, you can't get outside the Milky Way to see what it looks like, but this is what people imagined it would be like if you could see it from edge on. And so you have this vast body of stars. People had figured out by then that the space was really big. They did not have a great idea of how big yet, but very, very big, but then it did peter off, and there was this sort of mushy edge that you just sort of disappeared off into, right? The Milky Way seemed to contain everything, and then it just trickled off. No well-defined edge, but basically nothing if you got far enough away. This was studied extensively from Herschel's time through the 19th century. So that by the end of the 1800s, people had done a lot of observational work, including spectroscopy. They knew about redshifts by then, not of galaxies, those had not yet been measured, but they knew about stars were moving around. relative to each other. They could recognize different spectral types of stars, though that had not yet been formalized in the system we use today. And this whole idea of star counts had been reproduced many times, to the point where there's this statement by Agnes Mary Clerc, who was sort of the, I don't know if you follow any popular science writers, but she was that of the day. And she wrote a Popular History of Astronomy in 1890 with this very certain statement that no competent thinker with the whole of the available evidence before him can now, it is safe to say, maintain any single nebula to be a star system of coordinate rank with the Milky Way. A practical certainty has been attained that the entire contents, stellar and nebular, of the sphere belong to one mighty aggregation, i.e. the Milky Way. Pretty stern stuff, huh? Everything is in the Milky Way, both the stars and the things we're calling nebula at that point, things that we will come to learn are galaxies many times. And there were different kinds of nebulae. Some are gas clouds that are in the Milky Way, but some really are star systems of coordinate rank with the Milky Way. You'd be stupid to believe that, right? So again, these things change, right? This was not an unreasonable thing to say at the time. It was an unreasonable thing to say, a bit too certain. But I emphasize that because we never want to be too certain. I still hear people say the same kinds of things about cosmology today, and I just worry it's going to sound that stupid a century before. So here's a Hubble picture. Almost all of these things are star systems of coordinate rank to the Milky Way. There are just lots and lots and lots and lots of galaxies out there, just as the Milky Way is made of hundreds of billions of stars. There are tens, maybe hundreds of billions of galaxies within the horizon that we can observe of the universe. That's a big number. It's worth thinking about that number. What, there are 7, maybe 8 billion people on Earth by now? If you gave each of us a starship to go visit things, we'd each have to visit of order 100 stars each. One ship per person. Every old person, every baby gets in their own ship and goes and visits 100 stars before we've visited every star in the galaxy. It's a big freaking place. Okay. So, one of the puzzles that comes out of that, though, is referred to as Olber's paradox. I forget when Olber was, a long time ago, but centuries ago, not millennia ago. And his paradox can basically boils down to, why is the sky even dark at night? So if we live in an infinite universe, it's sort of like being in the midst of a forest, right? You go out and you look, and if the forest is really thick, eventually your line of sight will hit a tree. Right. And that's not true in this photo, right? There are some gaps there. You can see the end of the forest. But it's easy to imagine being in a forest that's big enough where you cannot see out through the trees. Every sight line intersects a tree trunk. Well, now, if the universe is really infinite in spatial extent, you're going to see something, no matter which way you look. Eventually, your sight line will hit a star. And so every sight line should eventually hit a star. And in a Euclidean geometry, important junction as the geometry we're used to dealing with, surface brightness is distance independent. Basically, if you have a patch of a star, then you move that further away and it gets smaller, but you've also taken that amount of light and crammed it into that smaller area. And both of those vary by the square of the distance. So the surface brightness, how bright that patch of the surface of the star is, that is distance independent. And so the entire sky should look like the surface of the average star. No matter which way you look, that's what you're going to eventually see. And it doesn't matter how far away the average star is, because the surface brightness is distance independent. So why doesn't the sky look like the sun?
It's actually not an easy question to answer. So I'll just leave it there. Now, in the Aristotelian case, no problem, the universe is not infinite. In the Stoic case, this is a bit harder, and that's why you do have to sort of have the object, in this case the Milky Way, kind of trail off. And so the space might be infinite, or at least indefinite, but the object is not. Everything is sort of concentrated towards the Milky Way, which is the mighty aggregation that Clark referred to. And then you could be off in the outskirts of the Milky Way. It's like driving out of town, right? You're in the city, lots of cool things, and you get to the suburbs and a bunch of boring houses, and then you get out to the exurbs, and then there are farms and trees, and, you know, not many people left. And so that was sort of what was imagined was going on, is just you got further away from the bright center of the universe, and it just tapered off. And so Olber's paradox was avoided in this cosmology just because the contents were finite. You ran out of stars for your line of sight to run into. So it's like that picture of the forest I saw. Yeah, there are a lot of trees, but you can see through them. There are not that many trees. And so this was actually one of the things informing Clark's assertion that it had to be that way. People were not dumb. There were reasons for what she was saying. And so, you know, you get away with Olber's paradox in the Aristotelian case just because the universe is finite. In the Stoic case, just because the contents are finite, even if space might be infinite. And you just can't avoid it in the Epicurean cosmology. So how did we get away from it? Well, so this brings us to 1920. I don't know if I'm boring you, but putting all of human history into that one lecture here, right? Spend the rest of the semester on modern cosmology. So in 1920, there was a great debate where these things were at issue, and there were many things to discuss, but the basic issues were the size and content of the Milky Way. So Shapley was sort of the champion of Clark's picture that, yeah, the Milky Way contains pretty much everything. But he said it was bigger than the standard picture of Herschel. But he did think all the nebulae, as they were called at the time, were basically clouds of gas within the Milky Way. Curtis was the more outspoken, and yet not. He advocated the Milky Way map as was basically as Herschel had found it. But he argued that the spiral nebulae, a particular class of nebulae, were stellar systems outside the Milky Way. That was the more outrageous of the things being discussed at the time. All right, this is a century ago. Not that long in terms of the history of science. Okay, so on that first point, Curtis basically took what would then be called the party line, and look, we've done the star counts, this is the map, it's basically the same as what Herschel found, that's what it is. Shapley pointed out the G's, there are these star clusters that we call globular clusters, big balls of stars. And they're all over on that same part of the sky. Yeah, there's one here and one there, but the vast majority of them are in the direction of Sagittarius. Isn't that weird? Why are all the globular clusters over there? And so here's a map he made out. There's the sun, and then each points are the locations of the globular clusters projected into the plane of the Milky Way. Right, so it's a 3D map, and some of them are pretty far out of the Milky Way plane. But we're looking in the plane of the Milky Way, so that. And look, all these things are over here in this direction. Oh, very few of them over there. What gives? So Shapley argued that we were not, in fact, at the center, that this was an incomplete map, and the real center was somewhere over here, near the center of all these globular clusters. Okay.
this is an example of where the map you make really affects the picture you have, the universe that we live in. And so in retrospect, we would see that Shapley is right. Here's another depiction of that. Now this is out of the plane. So you can see that some of them are very high up out of the plane. Most of the stars are in this plane. But the sun is here, and most of them are concentrated around here. And we would put the nominal center of the Milky Way there today, right? So one nice thing about this is that we're not violating the Copernican principle. We're not in a special place that happens to be the center. Whereas that was true of Herschel's map and the ones following. And the reason that it appeared that we were close to the center of the mighty aggregation was that those maps were made incomplete because of dust. When you do the star counts, you're assuming all the stars are on average as bright as the sun. Reasonable assumption, using the inverse square law to map out things. Inverse square law only holds if space is transparent. If you put on sunglasses in different places, then you're dimming the stars in a way that is over and above just the inverse square law. And there isn't a lot of interstellar dust, but there's enough to mess with this method. And so in retrospect, we can say that the classic map of Herschel and Curtis and those in between, we're just looking at a sort of a small patch of the overall Milky Way. And those edges were defined more by the dust by anything real. Okay. That's still coming up in cosmology even today. Some of the debate is actively going on about the new JWST images, is how much is dust messing with our estimates of redshift. It's a bit more complicated, but it's still a real issue. Dust is just a big pain in the cahoot. This is a modern image of the sky reconstructed by Gaia data. Gaia is a European Space Agency satellite that is mapping the positions of all the stars that are bright enough to do. And it's going to get very precise, accurate locations and proper motion for billions of individual stars. So you can pile all that data up, and across the whole sky, this is what it looks like. Each glowing filament there is informed by measurements of the brightness of individual stars in each pixel. This is pretty much what your eye would see if you were up in space. And in fact, if you go out at night in a place that's dark enough where you can see the Milky Way, have any of you seen the Milky Way with your naked eye? All right, good. So some of you have. So then you know what I talked about. You can see this, right? It gives a very patchy image across this. You can't see this part because it's in the southern hemisphere, right? So don't get that part. But you can see very easily by eye that there is a concentration. So you know where the plane of the Milky Way is. You can see that it gets brighter as you go this way. This part never arises in the northern hemisphere. But you can tell where the center is getting towards. Another thing about looking at this is an all-sky projection, so this is the center of the Milky Way. It wraps around your head just the way you project a map of the Earth onto a piece of paper. It doesn't entirely work. So this wraps around to meet that, and so this is the galactic anti-center at either side. And so this is sort of the 90-degree version. You can see the large and small Magellanic clouds. Those are small satellite galaxies to our own Milky Way. Again, you can only see them in the southern hemisphere. You go there, and it's really obvious. In fact, the first time I observed in Chile, a lot of good telescopes in Chile, I went out to do my checks at night, and it's like, what are those clouds doing there? Oh, right, okay. So, you know, again, just where we are, most people live in the northern hemisphere, because that's where most of the land is, and you're just deprived of that view. The sky's skies are better in the southern hemisphere just because of the way the solar system is tipped relative to this. But you can see the dust structure here, which is my real point, and you can see that by eye. It's really hard to tell just by looking that that's what's going on, and now in retrospect, it's pretty clear. All right, so Shapley had that part right. What Curtis had right was the nature of the spiral nebulae.
Those magellanic clouds.
Sorry, these?
Yeah. No, we're the spiral nebulae that Curtis was talking about those.
Ah, so Curtis was thinking about things that looked like that in general.
Okay.
So those are all over the sky. They don't have that large angular extent. So
I think that's Andromeda.
That little fuzzy thing there. You can't see the individual. Gaia is looking for the individual stars, so it doesn't matter. So you can actually see that better with your eye than Gaia does here, even though Gaia does better for everything else, right? So yeah, good question. So what people had noticed, they've been photographing the sky for a long time, is that there were a lot of things that looked like that, except on the scale they were like that. Because this is the entire sky. And just what those things were because they're far enough away, we know now, that you couldn't resolve them into individual stars. All you saw were these pretty little spirals, and they were fuzzy things otherwise. And so a lot of them thought that they were, a lot of people thought that they were spinning clouds of gas, pinwheels, literally. In fact, the first time pictures were shown to the Royal Society of London, people said that the nebular hypothesis made visible. Because the idea at the time was that planets formed by the condensation of gas clouds. That's how the solar system formed. It's still pretty much how we think the solar system formed. And people leapt to the conclusion that in these spiral nebula, they were seeing other planetary systems being formed by that same process. Nebular hypothesis made visible. That is, you're seeing the formation of planets in these spiral nebulae. No. So, if you look at the ALMA data where you do image the gas around protostars, things that are still forming, they do kind of look like that. So, it was a perfectly reasonable thing to infer, and they had no idea how far away these things were. And so, those distance measurements were critical. How do you measure the distance? And so this was a big thing of what they were arguing about. They didn't really know how far away they were. Now, one kind of event that was known at the time were novae. These are sometimes repeating, often not, but just stars that grew real bright and fade away. By this time, people had recognized that they had sort of a characteristic brightness. So if you use that characteristic brightness, and you could calibrate that. That's always the trick, is calibrating these standard candles, as they're called. Then you could make a distance estimate. And so one of the biggest spiral nebulae is Andromeda, M31. You can see that just barely with your naked eye if you're in a really dark place. And Shapley said, look, we've seen Nova go off there, and that places it at a distance that's still clearly within the bounds of the Milky Way. It's just something within the mighty aggregation, just like Clark taught us. Curtis had the more radical idea that these were sort of island universes. The Milky Way was this vast collection of hundreds of billions of stars. But there could be other islands of hundreds of billions of stars of coordinate rank, stellar systems of coordinate rank. And so he imagined that M31 was one of these, and he pointed out these things have dust lanes. We see in the Milky Way, and of course he's the one who didn't properly account for dust in his map. But you could see them. You could see them edge on. In fact, it's easier to see them in other galaxies. And so he says that's kind of weird. But what's really weird is M31 has had lots of these novae. If it's just some little patch in the Milky Way, why is it having so many more novae than everywhere else in the Milky Way? That don't make no sense. And so there were a couple of important observations that favored the interpretation that these were still within the Milky Way. One is that the nova that we just talked about
Two is that there was observations by this chap, Van Manen, at the time, that he actually had taken multiple pictures on multiple nights, and he claimed to see the rotation of these things. Well, okay, if you can actually see them moving from night to night, they had to be pretty close, didn't they? Those are just wrong, right? They didn't really understand about seeing back then, and so he was taking images of the same nebulae at night after night, but the seeing conditions were variable, and so you got a different image. And so, yeah, the images changed. But it was because your observation conditions changed, not because the thing was actually physically rotating. But if you believe that, then, and there was no reason to doubt it at the time, then that was a pretty convincing argument that these things were not far away. Just turns out it was wrong. And that happens a lot in astronomy. We do our best and just get things wrong. The thing with the novae, it turned out that was a supernova. We didn't know about supernova yet. That's why it's supernova. They're a lot brighter than ordinary nova. And so, knowing that now, they're a lot further away.
Poor damn Shapley.
He was right, right? He won.
yeah.
Stupid Van Manen, right? So, you know, looking back on it now, you'd say Shapley got that part about the spiral nebulae wrong. They really are external galaxies. At the time, I think people think he won the debate for the reasons I just laid out. In retrospect, we see those reasons were wrong. But at the time, they were pretty convincing. He was also right about the Milky Way being big. At the time, people had a split decision, and so thought Curtis got that. So our interpretation of the Great Debate now seems to be different from what people had at the time. Now, I'm not that old, so I wasn't there. And so I don't know if I actually have that right. That's my impression from reading some of the history of this, but I'm not sure I entirely trust that. Anyway, we have a pretty clear picture of what happened now, that this map of Herschel's was just a limited patch of what you could easily see before dust really messed with you. And so the thing that really pushed us over the edge for the nature of the spiral galaxies were Hubble's observations of Cepheids in nearby spirals, relatively nearby, far away compared to the Milky Way. So Cepheids were again a kind of variable star that was already known at the time, and people had been watching them long enough to figure out that there was a correlation between their period and their average brightness. So you just plot the brightness of one of these things, they sort of putter along, and they, woo, it gets really bright, and then it fades off, and there's this sawtooth pattern that's very characteristic, and it makes it easy to measure the period of that variation. You have to be patient and observe the same thing over and over and over again to build up this time series. But if you do that for lots of stars, then you can calibrate the luminosity of these Cepheids as a function of the time. And it didn't have to correlate. But it turns out it's basically a function of the size. These are stars that are physically pulsating. There is an instability in their outer layers that is driven by transition between neutral and ionized hydrogen, and that changes the opacity of the layers and basically causes this rhythmic pulsation. And the bigger the star is, the longer it takes to pulsate, and the brighter it is, right? It's a lot more complicated than that. But to zeroth order, that's good enough. The bigger they are, the brighter they are, the longer they take to pulse. And so you can measure that period of oscillation. And if you can measure the distance, right, it's easy to measure the brightness. It's hard to measure the distance. So you have to figure out a way of measuring the distances. But if you can do that, there are lots of ways to do that, then you can calibrate this correlation. And then that's great because you can go out and find, these are bright, right? The brightest Cepheids are tens of thousands of times brighter than the sun. So you can see those individual stars way far away. And Hubble could see them in all the way to Andromeda. Right. And so you measure the period, and that is a distance-independent quantity that is predictive of a distance-dependent quantity. Right? You know the absolute luminosity, you can measure the apparent brightness,
and the difference is given by the inverse square law. That's a measure of the distance. And there's a formula people had worked out and figure out what the distance modulus is. All this stuff is couched in terms of the distance modulus, the difference between the apparent magnitude and the absolute magnitude that the thing would have if it were 10 parsecs away, because that was an interesting distance when the quantity was defined. Very local by today's standards. And so Hubble was doing this program all through the 20s, enabled by the 100-inch Hooker telescope that had been put on Mount Wilson just in 1917. So. He was in the right place at the right time. He was basically the only person with access to a telescope that could do this project. And he did it. He took pictures of Andromeda night after night, and he noticed, oh, look, this star is different from night to night to night. And that was that's his writing on the plate. It's actually a physical photographic plate, and he took a little wax crayon and said, yay, there it is. And you can still go to the Carnegie Observatories, and if you ask nicely, they'll show you. So he found Cepheids, and he was able to map out this distance, and this was unambiguous. He wrote a series of three very important papers starting in 1929, and it very clearly showed that Andromeda was well outside the extent of the Milky Way, to solve the great debate. So galaxies were then, from thenceforth, seen as stellar systems of coordinate rank. And so this is what the entire sky looks like now, not in stars, but in galaxies. So this is from the two-mass galaxy survey. This was a ground-based infrared survey. The brightness of the dots are the numbers of galaxies. The colors are their redshift. So you can start to see the three-dimensional mapping there. This hazy spot there, that is the plane of the Milky Way, which the dust of which still obscures the galaxy behind that. But other than that, you can see these huge stretches, and every one of these dots is a galaxy like the Milky Way. Some farther away, some closer, but you can see now there are large structures over huge amounts of the sky, and places that are pretty blank, voids. And so that's why this class includes the large-scale structure of the universe, because there is. It's just not galaxies flung out there randomly, but there are lots of structure to how they are distributed on the sky. They fill out these filamentary structures, long walls, they congregate into clusters, and all these structures form big empty regions called voids. So basically Hubble did that, showed the galaxies were far away. He also gave us the basic morphology classification system that we still use today, for better or for worse, and later discovered the expansion of the universe, which underpins the rest of the discussion of what we'll talk about for the rest of the course. So we'll pick that up again next time. Any questions? Okay, well, like I say, always feel free to interrupt me, and I will see you on Thursday. I will try to post the first homework so you have a look at it, and post that news on the course website.
There's a way to make up for the midterm, because I will be going for a conference during the week of our midterm.
Okay.
So I might have to miss the midterm. So.
Well, that's just terrible, but we'll work it out.
Okay, because like I saw the midterm is on October 20th, but then I will be leaving in the week of 18th. So
right.
It's like basically.
When would you get back?
I have no idea about the exact dates of the conference.
So when that becomes clear, let me know, and we'll figure something out.
Sure. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Sorry about
that. No problem. There's always something.
Yeah. It's like